and welcome back to the Dreamcast. I am your host, Denise Walsh. I combine science, scripture, and stories that will inspire you to dive deep, break through your own personal glass ceiling, and design a life of your dreams. All right, big welcome back to the Dreamcast. I am really excited about our next guest because he is an inventor and innovator. He was born in New Jersey and raised in Denmark, came back to school in the U.S., but still considers Denmark his home and travels back and forth regularly. He learned a lot from his father, who was an engineer and an inventor who held many patents. And when he was only 16, he was a contributor to a successful patent along with his father, a medical device that led to the launch of a wound care company called Euromed. After college, he started working at Euromed, mixing adhesive, which led to many more patent filings. I don't know if you guys know much about this world, but my grandfather actually had a patent as well. And it's just so interesting to learn how to do that and what that looks like. And when you are an inventor, you're basically a visionary. You're seeing things differently and seeing the way the world could be better. And yeah, so our guest uses his real passion, which is to solve the world's problems. Because as a visionary, you see the world a bit differently. And he's applied his thinking to America's economy in the book Optimizing America. Through vivid scenery, memorable characteristics, and intense drama, he encourages the reader to ponder hardline questions that challenge modern political pundry, shatter the news in the loop cycle, and change the way we think about the distribution of wealth. So please welcome Jarl Jensen to the Dreamcast.
Thank you very much, Denise. That was quite an introduction.
Well, I'm excited to hear a bit more of your story because I know starting at 16, you already saw the world differently. What was it like growing up with a father who is an engineer and an inventor?
Well, he was very busy. He was also very successful. He took lots of risks. He's the kind of person who would make a lot of money and spend it on houses. And I certainly don't recommend that. My mom still has houses, two houses in Denmark, a house in France, and two houses here in the States. That kind of spending kind of leads to, I think, uncomfortable financial situations as you spend all the money as you go. I certainly am not planning to do that going forward. From his interacting with my dad, the time I did have with him, one of the moments I really remember, besides story, he used to tell me stories when I would go to bed. That really influenced me. But also a game we played called the invention game. He would pick things out of an old garage, and we would compete to come up with different uses for whatever that object was. And that sort of really got me started at a young age to think differently about how to use things and so on.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're really getting and using, cultivating that creative mind.
Right.
Is that something you do with your kids today?
I do. One of my sons is very curious. We actually all try to play the invention game. But my one son is a little bit more interested in it. My daughter is also interested in it at times. Kids have a lot more places to YouTube is just so popular. They can learn anything through a search. So my invention game isn't as appealing as it was when I was growing up.
Yes, you have to keep up with the technology here. Well, very cool. So at 16, you created your first patent and then spent years working with the company that your dad started. And it sounds like you, when he passed away, you took over and helped to revive it. Tell me how it went from zero to making a profit in about 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a story. The Euromed was originally a partnership between Hollister, which is a very large medical device company, and my father as sort of a side business to another patent on ostomy, which is for colon cancer. This sister company, Euromed, was for wound care using similar technologies. That really didn't go very far for about 6 years. And then, Hollister offered to buy the company from my father, and my father said, for that price, I'll buy it from you. And they agreed. And, Euromed, Inc. was formed, originally, it was a part of a company out of Denmark called Dansac. So when the company was reformed here in the States, unfortunately, my father got leukemia and passed away just as he made this big deal, which, as I originally stated, he spent quite a bit of money on this. And my whole family, my mother's financial future was at risk. And so we were put into this situation. I call it the Genghis Khan situation, where you bring the mother, your wife and children, and you go to war on a boat. And so you can imagine, if you don't win that battle as you get off the ship, your wife and kids are literally, their lives are at risk. So you fight all hell. And that's sort of the situation we were in. And basically, I was put in a situation where I had to, with very little money, we had to take this under foreclosure building that my father had already bought before he passed away, and turn it into a clean room, a medical device manufacturing building. We also had to build from basically drawings these machines that would make these products. And we had to do it all within a very short timeline because we did have some orders and we needed to ship them. And so basically, given the urgency and the need to deliver, we got all these things done in about 6 months. It was sort of a miracle, but I can tell you I didn't sleep much. I gained weight. I had acne, all kinds of health problems. I was only 26. But the need to succeed made us succeed, and it's the thrill of thinking back to it. But and there's so many sub stories to that story. It's actually a very exciting time in my life.
Yeah, 26 years old, you had a strong why and the deadline to make it happen. So you probably did more, created more, experienced more than you ever thought you could.
It really was fascinating because, it was a big, about a 40,000 square foot building, and we had a clean room. We had a lab for innovation and developing products. We had the offices. We had a mixing room where we would mix the adhesive, a packaging room. We had a machine shop. And every single corner of that building, from the epoxy flooring to the HEPA filters that went into the ceiling to make the class 100,000 clean room, every single detail I knew and made happen. And it was just this unbelievable time of the need to learn incredibly fast and the need to execute incredibly fast. Dealing with contractors as a 26-year-old,
yeah,
let me tell you, that is a lesson in negotiation that maybe everybody should have.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I feel like so many times people have a dream and maybe they see the vision, but they don't know how to execute or they don't know how to do it. And that how slows people down so often. There's a lot of times we just give up before we even try because we don't really know the how. But when you're put in a situation where you have to, there's ways to figure everything out.
That is exactly right. And I would agree that knowing too much about what you need to do in order, and you're trying to make a decision on knowing what you need to do in order to succeed in business, I'm not sure that's a good idea. I think the Genghis Khan approach might be a better idea. And maybe that's why my dad was so successful. He constantly put himself into a situation where financially he needed to succeed.
Oh, you create situations where you get your adrenaline pumping. You have that strong why, and then the deadline. So the only option is forward movement, action, success.
Correct. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
So you have a lot of experience in your teens and early 20s, learning from your dad, being kind of jumping into these business situations. You played the invention game. How did all of that lay the groundwork for your future work?
Well, immediately after we started shipping our first products, we immediately went to work on redesigning the product line in order, because they weren't profitable. They weren't high quality. They really weren't competing against the more advanced product lines on the market. So I redesigned the products, lowered the cost by 50%. And while doing that, also launching a consumer product line, and those really led to those, that work and those designs and those patents that we filed from that period of time wound up, causing the company to really, grow very fast over the next, 5 years. And then ultimately led to the sale, in about 15 years later, where we reached about $20 million and we got a fantastic offer to sell, and we did.
Congratulations. That's, and I mean, I, one of the things I love is we really are constantly growing and kind of busting through our own personal glass ceiling. And so at 26 years old, you took over your dad's company and not just made it grow, but made it thrive. And that now you really have the ability to give back and take everything that you've learned and offer value to the world in a different way. So what did you do after that?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, obviously business is always busy. There's always challenges. I wound up, initially I was the R&D manager, and that's where I spent my time redesigning not only the products, but the processes and coming up with new product lines. But by 2004, 5 years later, I became the CEO and, started, leading from that position. And, from there, we grew the company basically, but doubled the company to 20 million. And, we formed a board, which I think is incredibly important to if you ultimately want to sell a company, you need to have a highly functional board that can control the company so that when a company wants to buy it, they know that they can control the company through managing the board. If a company has to come in there and there's a CEO or a person in charge who does everything, wears all the hats, it's very difficult for a company to take the risk that they might not be able to manage the company properly. But with a well-functioning board, selling a company is much more attractive for a buyer.
Okay. Interesting. Very interesting. And once you sold it, what happened next?
I really, again, my passion has always been around ideas. So I started a company called Inventagon, where I focus on inventions, helping people and myself, for that matter, file patents properly and explore opportunities that come from ideas. And along the way, I've learned that many lessons about innovation, invention, the differences between those two, and the importance of finding the right people to work with to bring ideas to fruition.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because in order to have a successful business, you need a little bit of everything, right? You need to have the visionary who can see where we're going, even if the road isn't paved there. You know, we always say the pioneer is the one out kind of slashing through the wilderness and creating a path for people to follow. So you need to have the visionary, but then you also need the people about the details, and you need the executors, and you need a bunch of different hands on deck. So what type of person do you look for to add to your team?
Well, at this point, I look for expertise in the field of the invention. So, for example, I'm a part of two startups. One is in orthodontics, and I am working with two active orthodontists that have active practices, and they see patients every day. And I also am working with the founder who used to work as a university professor in orthodontics, and they had these ideas dating all the way back to the 80s about how to move teeth faster. And when working with this group, I can really apply my knowledge about how to bring ideas to the marketplace properly, how to patent them properly, how to innovate properly. So I'm really leading, helping them lead them to success through developing this technology finally after so many years that they've been kind of trying to get this to market. And now we're doing some trials, and it's very exciting. And so that's what I mean by finding the right people. I think if you're going to be working with ideas, you need to have people who are actively working with those ideas in the marketplace to make sure that what you're doing will be useful for them.
Yeah, you have the skills of a vision, inventing, innovation, but they have the expertise in the field. So together, you guys can really create a powerhouse, because you can live and breathe your skill set, and they can live and breathe their skill set, and together you can make a lot of things happen.
Yeah, and the reason why I absolutely insisted that they be partners in this company that's going to commercialize this is because that they bring so much value to the development of the product. Without their insights, you're kind of going blind. You need people who are actively in this, practicing whatever the field of the invention is, in order to really develop the product properly.
So how has your experience as an inventor impacted your ideas about the economy? Like how do they relate?
Well, my mind is one that always, I'm a daydreamer. I'm always contemplating different things all the time, sort of my personality, a little bit of a daydreamer, or maybe very much so. But there's something really funny about the economy, how it works, but especially really the economy was really exposed for what it was in the 2007-2008, the Great Recession, and the quantitative easing, the bailing out of the banks, not people. I think most people are like kind of curious and thought that's kind of strange. So when you delve into it, the economy, they tell everybody that the economy is an art, it's a social science, it's based on psychology. That's very strange. There's nothing else in the universe that's like that. We don't go to a frog and say, well, their ecosystem is based on how they interact with each other. That's crazy, right? The ecosystem is based on nature and the weather, and it's very scientific, and scientists can go study a frog's life and its ecosystem. But when it comes to humanity's ecosystem, which is its economy, we're not scientists don't touch that. It's not scientific. It's more of an art. And there's a reason why it's probably the only thing in the universe that does not behave like all the other systems in the universe. And that is because the economy has been bought and paid for by the commercial banks. And the commercial banks run every single central bank around the world. And this has huge implications for our lives, our ecosystem. Our ecosystem is owned by commercial banks. What does that mean? Well, let me tell you the backstory to how the commercial banks took over our economy. And it all happened a long time ago, and innocently, perhaps enough. But back in 1907, the American government went bankrupt, and J.P. Morgan bailed out the American government with his own money. And in return, in 1913, the Congress passed laws that gave control to the economy, basically, the America's central bank, to the commercial banks. The commercial banks called this new company the Federal Reserve. Mm. So what does that mean? That means that the amount of money in the system and how money is printed and put into the economy is controlled by commercial banks. And basically, as it started out, it was probably a good thing that commercial banks had control over money flows. But as time went on, the commercial banks' business interest started taking over. So by the 1920s, they went off the gold standard and went to a fractional gold standard. Why would they do that? Well, the more money they can print for the gold they had, right, the more loans they could make as commercial banks. And obviously that's their business. Commercial banks want to make loans. That's how they grow their business. Fast forward to Nixon and 1972. Nixon was selling, or the Federal Reserve, the Treasury had to sell gold to the rest of the world because they didn't want to buy American product. They started buying America's gold reserve because that's what was backing up the dollar. Nixon said, no, I don't want to sell any more gold. We're going to run out. And so this is what created fiat money. Now, why is that to the benefit of the bankers? That means the bankers can now loan out as much money as they can print or as much money as they can loan to people who can pay back the money they borrowed. Now, this is right around the time when things started going kind of wrong. Ever since the creation of fiat money, ever since the banks got the right to print as much money as they could loan out, property values have skyrocketed, which means the cost of living has increased as a percentage of your income, which means you have to pay more for your house, you have to pay more in your mortgage bills, which leaves less for everything else. The cost of living is going up because commercial banks have an infinite supply of money to loan out. And the reason that is because there's a limited number of houses, but there's an infinite number of mortgages to buy those houses. So the price of the house goes up, and that means the cost of living goes up right along with it. And so when you look, the deeper you take the storyline, the more you start thinking, well, this isn't really working out for us anymore because automation is replacing people at work. And now why is that happening? That's happening because the price of a robot or a machine that replaces 2, 3, 4 people at work can be financed through a loan from the bank. Now, that loan would never have happened if the banks didn't have access to infinite amounts of loans. And so automation is really a consequence of this infinite supply of debt or money printing that the banks have access to. So there's a lot of bad things going on in the economy, in our world. The cost of living is going up. People are losing their jobs. Technology is out of control. I mean, we all saw what happened with the Facebook in the last election. We all know what's going on with the iPhone and the addiction to it. It's hard to even have a conversation without checking your email. I'm hoping you're not checking yours right now. We're really heading in a very strange direction. There is no control over where we're going. I can tell you the one thing that technology is driving, and it's being driven by the banking system. The technology that will come next is the technology that will either replace old technology because it's better, faster, cheaper, or it will replace people because it's better, faster, cheaper. None of these things are really good for us or humanity anymore. Now, every single Fortune 500 company has an artificial intelligence project. Why are we spending so much money investing in technology that basically replaces our thinking or our need to think? I don't really think that's good for anybody. So there's a host of world problems. The next thing you can look at is jobs. Jobs have become so important that at least half of the country is willing to risk the future of the planet with climate change so that they can have a job today. Well, why are jobs so important all of a sudden? Well, jobs are so important, number one, because the Federal Reserve defines full job or the full employment as around 5% unemployment. 5% unemployment means there's more than 10 million Americans unemployed. That doesn't seem like full employment, but why do they have such a high full employment number? Because if it gets any lower, they're afraid of inflation. And if inflation gets too high, their commercial products, their loans will become unappealing. And that will obviously hurt the commercial banks. So low interest rates actively works against the working man. High interest rates actively supports the working man. Why? Because it makes technology, automation, robotics too expensive to compete against human labor. And these are the kinds of things we need to start thinking about. And so what I have written is a book that basically, and now it's several books, that raises the issue of what if commercial banks didn't run the Federal Reserve, didn't run the central banks all across the world? What happens if we re-engineer the monetary policy to support humanity as opposed to supporting commercial banks? What happens when you do that is you start getting ideas about how to create an advanced economy that is still very capitalistic, that still supports wealthy people and their property, but creates a tremendous amount of jobs. We can have full employment near 0% if only we had proper control and proper management of our monetary policy. We can address climate change without hurting the job picture. We can address pollution, the plastics in the oceans, without affecting or having the government spend too much money. We can address poverty, eliminate it very simply, without having the government go bankrupt with social programs. So we can, in fact, reduce the size of government significantly by redesigning the monetary policy and getting the commercial banks out of the Federal Reserve. This is why I'm incredibly passionate about this, especially with my kids growing up. I really am worried about their future and what they're going to be doing as they grow up.
Wow. So, I mean, I can hear your passion for sure. And as an idea man, you've always seen things differently. You know, you've always kind of said, okay, how can I make this better? How can this be tweaked? What's an out of the box solution? And so you've taken that vision that you grew up with, that you've cultivated, that has built several businesses, and you've said, how can the world's economy be different? And through that lens, that's where Optimizing America was born.
That's right. And I, at this point, I've written supporting books that are more technically oriented, so it's like engineering the economy. Also I've done a history of America's economy as well. So those two, I call those booklets, they're also available on Amazon. But again, it's about not informing and educating everybody. But I am starting to organize. This needs to turn into a social movement for change. This is the linchpin. You can take all the other issues and that people have, that our people are, but this is the issue that is the challenge for our future. We need to change this one thing, and almost everything else starts getting a lot better. Let me just address that. Optimizing America is a book, but I want to turn it into a movement. So anybody who's listening, sign up, email me directly. Let me know you're interested, because I'm looking for help. I'm looking for people to join me.
Awesome. Yes, all the links to Optimizing America and ways to get in touch with Jarrell will be in the show notes and description box below. Is Optimizing America, it says here, vivid scenery, memorable characters. So is this a nonfiction story to kind of take people through this journey?
That's right. This has to be economics is often shunned as something not very interesting and boring. But let's face it, it's the human ecosystem. And I wanted to tell a story that was interesting, easy to read. It is also available on Audible, by the way, so you can just listen to it. And by listening to this very entertaining story, people will start to get the idea of why things aren't working anymore.
Awesome. So you're really, and one question I have is, it sounds like too, you're asking people to start being a bit more visionary too. We're saying, okay, let's all think outside the box here. Let's all kind of, what if the world was a little bit different and we made this, tweaked this one thing, how would the domino effect impact the rest of our lives? And so how can us as listeners, as you're teaching the skill and helping to grow our, kind of give us some new brain cells, how can we be more innovative? How can we be more solution focused? And why is this a good thing?
Well, again, it depends on where people are. If they are in the invention, they're looking for that idea to start a business. I would suggest to look everywhere, be inspired by everything, and think about doing everything that you are looking at differently. How could it be done better? But more importantly, look at things that aren't working properly and really pay attention there, because that's obviously the opportunity. I think when people are in business and if they're having some success, I think it's very important to focus on that business, not starting new businesses, not starting other ideas, but really focus in on the better, faster, cheaper aspect of that business. So again, it all depends on where people are in their lives and what approach they should take.
Yeah, starting to think and just keep opening your eyes to how could this be different? How could this be better? How can this be easier? I feel like my husband's a lot like that. He's a visionary and he's always not necessarily like opposed to the status quo, but just didn't fall into it immediately. He's always kind of looking for something different. And I think that's one reason why we started our business, is because he was a visionary in our family and said, no, we need to own our own time. We can do something ourselves. And it's changed our family forever. So I have another kind of random question for you, because I know that there's a lot of people listening that do want more for their lives. They do see the world differently. They don't fall in line to that status quo, but it's not always easy. You know, we hit ups and downs along the way. You said at 26, you took over a company and had to learn a lot quickly. You've had a lot of patents along the years. Have you had something that you worked really hard on and maybe it didn't work, or nobody bought it, or what was a learning curve that you had along the way?
Well, the thing about working with ideas is that you can have the very best idea that can, one example that didn't work was a packaging idea I had. Basically, it was to redesign a cereal box, or boxes in general, by reinforcing the columns. And by doing so, you could reduce the amount of paper or board used per cereal box by about 25%. And when you look at the data, that means about, for Kellogg's, for example, that means about $10 million savings a year, or about $1 million in savings a month. But when I went to visit Kellogg and I went to visit other packaging companies, the business model is so vertically integrated that and Kellogg, which would have to have pushed this through, even though it's a good idea, the business model, the packaging companies, they don't want to. They get their paper from the paper mills that they own, so they're not really interested in reducing the amount of paper used. And Kellogg's had the problem that they are a union shop, and changing anything there is incredibly difficult. And so it was, basically ignored. And so the problem with ideas is that the market may not be ready for it. And this is where you really need to have professionals that are in deep into that business really be there to help push this along, because they're more aware of the timing, the needs of the industry, and so on. So it's very important that when you evaluate the idea that you think is the best in the world, that you start small, that you add people with insight, and you keep it hands on as well. And I think those would be my, those are my lessons from where things have not worked out.
Yeah. And it sounds like now you're taking that own advice. You're not just jumping in. You're really getting the experts surrounding you to make sure the right thing is pushed forward.
Right. Exactly.
My grandpa was, he got the patent on, it was a coating that made aluminum bumpers on cars not rust. So I don't even know when it was, 30s, 40s. He had the patent on this coating. Interestingly enough, they then came out with plastic and they no longer needed that because, you know, plastic doesn't rust. But it's cool that he had a vision, saw a problem, and then worked to fix it.
Well, it's going to be like that with all inventions. Eventually, it's something better, faster, cheaper is going to come out. I mean, that's the art of innovation, is that it's going to keep evolving.
That's true. That's true. So what is one thing that you've invented, have a patent on, or a vision that you had that you're really proud of?
Well, I have several patents in regards to wound care that they're a little bit technically complicated, but the processes that we developed, the adhesives that developed were the state of the art and led to incredible surge in profitability for the company. Obviously that led to the great success that Uramed was. So obviously that's gotta be some of the things that I'm most proud of. I'm working on some other exciting technologies right now, but those particular patents and those that particular period of time was definitely the most innovative and most impactful on my career.
Very cool. All right, I have a few more questions, and one is the pros and cons to risk taking, because you said, you know, your dad taught you a lot of what to do, but then also maybe what not to do. And so what would you say the pros and cons are to taking a step in a direction that maybe nobody else has been?
I'm under the belief, especially when it comes to starting up, working with ideas, that less is more. Spending less money is more effective. I think the more money you throw at developing an idea or starting up a business, the more complicated it gets, and the less likely you are to succeed, obviously also because you're spending more money. But less money means that you're working on things hands-on, you're doing it yourself, and really that is what's necessary to succeed in those stages. I can't think of a worse idea than throwing a lot of money at a new idea. I think that's just the absolute worst idea.
And when you're hands-on, it's your baby. You know, you own it. You're so excited about it. I feel like that's when time goes by so fast and you don't even realize it. You know, it's not that forced action where you're sitting and bored out of your mind and time's ticking so slowly. But when you're working on something, you're keeping it simple. You're all in yourself. It's exciting. It's fun. You grow in the process, and then you can keep costs down because you're owning it.
Yeah. And there's something to be said about actually doing and using your hands, if that's applicable, but whatever it is, when you're really into the details, you'll notice those opportunities for making things better. You'll notice how to design it better. And that's really what is going to, at the end of the day, make a superior design. That's what's going to make the product succeed, is those moments when you're really deep into the details. That's what's going to create that success.
How do you think that your visionary personality and kind of the legacy that your family has impacted your children today?
Well, they're still kind of young, but I mean, we are a close-knit family. I wake them up, or I wake up with my family, and I go to bed with my family every night. And we go to sleep early, but those are my habits that I try to instill in them, and get up early. I think every family has been evolving to, as the generations move on. I mean, my parents grew up in poverty in Denmark, back in the 40s and 50s. And so their definition of a healthy family is very different than mine. So, I think, every generation right now is evolving, as the way of life is changing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that you mentioned your dad was probably because of the generation he grew up in. He was working a lot and you might not have seen him as much as you would have liked to, but it sounds like you've changed that with your family. You're really invested in spending a lot of time, as much time as you can, with them, traveling from Denmark back to the States and showing them all the world's possibilities.
Yeah, absolutely. And the older they get, the more engaged I am with them, and I guess that's just natural. My father, coming from poverty, made money incredibly important to him, and also the times were different. I mean, the 70s and the 80s, business was really coming into this incredibly important place in the world. And, my father was part of that. And so in his generation, business and money was just the most important thing. I think that's slowly changing, but unfortunately, getting back to my book, the cost of living has gone up so much that everybody's worried about paying their bills, not making money. They're trying to pay their bills. In a lot of ways, I think for most people in America, things have turned back to money is everything. And that's unfortunate. I don't think that's the right direction for us. And actually, I know it's not. So hopefully I plan on changing that or helping to change that.
Awesome. Well, what is one way, what is one idea in optimizing America that you, that like could be that domino effect? You've said, what if the banks didn't own this Federal Reserve? Is there anything else that we can do as citizens to help change, like move the needle here?
Well, I mean, the one thing that the people have here is, we have the right to vote. But right now we don't have any options for voting out the Federal Reserve. In fact, we don't even get to, that's not part of what we vote for. We get to vote for presidents and senators and we get to vote on the local level. Interestingly enough on that, there was a vote in Switzerland called the Wahlgeld. So this was the first vote in, history where the Swiss actually voted to take the commercial banks out of their central bank. Now the vote failed, but the point is that this is becoming an issue, and this was the first time that they voted on it. And if they can do it in the Swiss can do it, perhaps we can get something started here in America as well. And that is what we need to do. We need to, I mean, think about it. Your ecosystem has been privatized. You know how they've privatized some prisons? Well, they've privatized our whole economy a long time ago. And I think the more time people spend thinking about that, the way they live, how much money they make, how much they pay for their house, the credit card bills, all of that is part of a privatized system owned by commercial banks. And America, after World War II, basically created the New World Order, where all the countries around the world operate the same way. They all have central banks owned by commercial banks. That's why the whole globe is drowning in debt. And, this has to end. It can't keep going. It's either going to end in a catastrophe, a complete reset, or we can change it now because we're intelligent enough to know what's going on.
Awesome. Well, Jarl, I want to acknowledge you for taking your experience in business and invention and visionary innovation, not only for creating success yourself, but then really giving back to everybody and in thinking about our economy in a new way that can impact and have that domino effect on all Americans and really all world citizens. And I know that I can feel it, like your passion about is really about teaching and cultivating this idea and really getting the word out. So guys, check out Optimizing America on Audible, on Amazon. I'll have all of the links in the description box, but then also connect with Jarl. And if you're interested in learning more about how you can rally behind this idea and join the social movement, then I urge you to take action here as well, because change is necessary. Change is happening, and we all certainly want to be a part of something that's going to better the world that we live in. So, Jarl, anything you want to add or end with today?
Yeah, there is something. When the Swiss voted on this Wahlgeld vote, the amount of economic obfuscation that went along with it, in other words, the population of the media basically was told false information about what the consequences was of bankers not running the economy, and they had fear mongering, like, oh, banks won't be allowed to make any more loans and all of these things, and so there's going to be quite a bit of what I call obfuscation, of confusion about what the consequences are of this. But let's face it, the consequences right now is that we're heading in a direction without any control. We don't know where technology is going. We don't know what's coming down the road. We're not even really fighting against climate change and all the other risks that we have as humanity. The linchpin of all that is the commercial banks. Now, are they going to give up that power? Probably not. They're not without fighting back. And I think their number one tool for that is confusion around how economics works and what it means to the average person. So that was the one thing.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you, and I'm excited to check more into this myself, because we all certainly want to be a part of something that's making the world better. So thank you so much.
Hey, thank you, Denise. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening today. Head over to denisewalsh.com. Enter your email to subscribe to our list, and I'll be sending out an early bird special coupon. 50% off, in fact, of the Dream Life Workbook when it is launched in just a few months. So if you want to have first dibs, let's get your name on that list. Thanks again. I so appreciate you. And remember to dream big.